There are people here in this country who sincerely believe that there is a decent job for every person who wants one. Our guest for this hour of focus, William Quigley, says people who believe that, sadly, unfortunately, are mistaken. He's professor of law, and he's also director of the Law Clinic and the Gillis Long Poverty Law Center at Loyola University in New Orleans. He's been an active public interest lawyer for over 20 years. In a book that we'll be talking about, a book titled Ending Poverty as We Know It, Guaranteeing a Right to a Job at a Living Wage, he says that we here in America value work and self-sufficiency, and because of that, it's time to make the right to a job at a living wage part of our national promise to each other. And in fact, he argues that we ought to do this by amending the Constitution. He sets all of this out in this book, Ending Poverty as We Know It. If you're interested in reading it, you can go look for it in the bookstore. It's published by the Temple University Press. Otherwise, questions and comments here are welcome on the program. 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just a little bit more about our guest, William Quigley. In addition to teaching law, he has litigated many cases with the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. He served as general counsel for the ACLU of Louisiana for 15 years. He also served as chair of the Louisiana Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, and with the many other local, state, and national legal and civil rights organizations. Professor Quigley, hello.
Hello, how are you, David?
I'm fine, thank you, and thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, I'm happy to be on the phone with you. I look forward to the conversation.
You start out by talking about some of the popular attitudes that people have about poverty and work, things that people believe that aren't true. And there are a number of them, and more than probably we need to talk to at least up front, but two that I think are worth starting with are, first of all, the belief that people have that most poor people don't work and that all we'd have to do to significantly deal with poverty in this country is, if those people would work, even at minimum wage, they would not be poor.
Right. Well, I think you put your finger on a couple of things that, you know, well-meaning people believe are true, but they just aren't. I mean, the solution to poverty, part of the solution to poverty is work. But as I point out, there are more than 30 million people in this country who work, most of them working full-time, who earn less than $8 an hour, which is a lot higher than the minimum wage, and they are, by any stretch of the imagination, still very poor in our country. And there are, as I think most people understand right now, because times are bad and have been pretty bad for a while, that there are over 10 million people who are not working and would like to work, plus a couple million more who are working part-time and would like to work full-time. So if you add just those two groups of people together, you're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 million people who either don't have a job or have a job and they don't earn enough to make ends meet. And those are people that most of us are very familiar with and, you know, see on a daily basis. People that, you know, we might see crossing guards, or people that take care of our kids or take care of our parents, or people that check us out at the grocery store or the drugstore. Plus a lot of other workers in this economy who are working and unfortunately have to work two jobs, maybe even just to meet the bills for the month, but are working. And so I think what a growing number of people are saying is that we need not just to talk about making poor people work, but having people who work have an opportunity to earn enough so that they are not poor anymore.
Hmm. One of the things that you suggest is that there's a problem with the way that we define poverty. And generally, I guess that is with the calculations that the government has made that says for an individual to have an adequate life you need this much income. And then as the family size goes up, if you talk about people who have children, then that number goes up. So there's an official kind of number that says this is the minimum income required to live and to support a family. And I think your argument, and probably a lot of other people's arguments, is that that is far too low, that that figure is just not realistic, and that, in fact, if we say, for example, that for a family of four, an income of $18,100 is adequate, that that is, in fact, far too low.
Right. I think, you know, I teach students, some of whom are young, some of whom are older and have families, and that, and when we talk about what does a person or what does a family really need to be able to survive, if you pay for child care, as most people do, if you have to have a car to get from where you live to where you work or where you go to school, and if you have an apartment and pay for food and pay for medical care and just the basic things, you're not going to get by on $18,000 for a family of four. You're just not going to make it. And I think because these guidelines are set artificially low, even the tens of millions of people that we think are in poverty and, you know, are a little bit ashamed about as a country, those tens of millions of people are really only about half of the number of folks that are living in poverty, because I use the definition of poverty, as my students do, which is poverty means that you need somebody else's help to get through the month, and whether that's your family or it's your church or it's a state or local government, if you need somebody's help, else's help to make it through the month, then you're poor. You have some dependence, and really getting out of poverty means getting to a point where you can take care of yourself, you can make your own choices, and take care of yourself and your kids. And so the idea of this book is, you know, if that's what we would like, and I think most all of us would like that, is the opportunity that everybody could actually take care of themselves. What are the things that we need to be able to do that? And the number one thing that everybody needs is a job. And many people who want to work don't have jobs. It's usually not a permanent situation for individuals. But then if you have a job, then the issue is, do I earn enough by working full-time to be able to support myself and my family? And that is just not the case for tens of millions of families in this country. So the idea of the book was, how do we guarantee people the right to a job and a job that earns a living wage, which I suggest the living wage should start at double what the minimum wage is for a single person, and probably there would have to be some wage subsidies for people above that, because $10 an hour is what an individual person needs to be able to make it if their employer's not providing health insurance. They got to take care of the whole gamut. If they're going to make it without government help, they need at least $10 an hour, and some places in the country, this country, more than that. So the suggestion of the book is that we have a constitutional promise that every person who wants to has the right to a job to earn a living wage. And it wouldn't force anybody to work, and it wouldn't force employers to keep people on who, you know, are not good workers or that, but it would be part of our national obligation or national basket of promises that we make to each other that we're serious about this, that we're going to give everybody who wants to work a chance to work themselves out of poverty.
Let me very quickly reintroduce our guest for this part of the show. William Quigley is professor of law at the Loyola University in New Orleans. He's also the director of the law clinic there and of the Gillis Long Poverty Law Center there. He's the author of a book that's titled Ending Poverty as We Know It, Guaranteeing a Right to a Job at a Living Wage. And it is out now. It's a paperback book. It is published by the Temple University Press. And questions, comments here on the show are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The Perhaps we'd talk a little bit more about the minimum wage, which is now, is it 515?
That's right, still 515. Been at 515 since 1997.
And it seems that I'm sure some people would argue that this concern you have of providing at least a floor, a minimum kind of income, that's what the minimum wage is supposed to address. Your suggestion for the living wage is twice that, $10 an hour, which is an enormous difference. Why is it that you would say that the minimum wage is so inadequate? There's an awful big difference between the current minimum and what you're suggesting for the living wage.
Yeah, well, the idea of the minimum wage has always theoretically been that people would earn enough to be able to live on. But the promise, we've never really followed through on that promise, and as you noted, it hasn't been changed in a couple of years, and it actually, as a promise of a decent wage, has been going backwards for a couple of decades. That if the minimum wage of today kept up with inflation, that the minimum wage of the 1960s, when I was earning a minimum wage, the minimum wage of the 1960s, if that had stayed up with inflation, it'd be something like $8.50 an hour now. So we, as a nation, we have really gone backwards in terms of the what we have committed ourselves to in providing a minimum wage, so that the minimum wage now is so far below what it really takes a person to be able to survive that it is quite a challenge to bring it from where it is to where it needs to be. But we have to, first of all, recognize that it used to be much more than it is, and then ask ourselves the question, well, why is it like this? And I think part of that is that we, over the last couple of decades, have not really taken the position that poor people and working people are central to our vision of what is important to us as the rest of the community. Poor people and low-wage workers are not big participants in electoral campaigns. They don't give big campaign contributions. They're usually not unionized. They usually are not necessarily even homeowners. And so they don't vote at the same percentage as higher income people do. They certainly don't contribute to campaigns in the same way. And unfortunately, our political system hasn't really kept their concerns at the forefront of our concerns. And that's why this book and the proposals that it suggests might seem like they are extraordinary, but there have been times in our history where we have, as a nation and as communities, have taken these kinds of thoughts very seriously. And I think it's time for us to do that again, and there are some signs that the nation is doing that at this point.
If you could do that, we could institute the living wage, what do you think that would do to the numbers of people that now are considered technically to be living in poverty, particularly, I guess, for those people who are the working poor, people who are working and yet don't earn enough money to get them above the poverty line?
Well, I think, you know, as I said, that's 30 million people that are making less than $8.20 an hour. A raise to $10 an hour at a minimum would, you know, put some real money in their pockets right off the bat. This is not the kind of, it's not a book that suggests that this is something that we should do by Thanksgiving or that we would do next year. That this is a book to organize the debate about this and the discussion about this. And if, in fact, we begin the movement toward changing ourselves from a minimum wage to a living wage, that we're going to have some transition in that time, because there would be a significant challenge to the small businesses and larger businesses in this country to be able to make that changeover. But if it is important, and if we say that people who work should be able to earn enough to live on, then we can start to put those transition things in place, whether a minimum wage would be converted to a living wage over a period of 3 or 4 years, whether in that time period that Congress would provide subsidies for employers to be able to offset some of the costs of that while it becomes integrated into the system, that there are a lot of ways that we can do it if we think it's, first of all, important, and second of all, doable. And in my experience in talking about this around the country, people do value it, that overwhelmingly, Democrats, Republicans, young, old, rich, poor, everybody agrees that people who want to work should be able to work, and people agree that people who work full-time ought to earn enough to make a living. So we start with that, but people don't believe it's possible. And so this book tries to explain some of the things that are happening out there where people have living wage campaigns, some of the other proposals that people have had for a right to a job and universal employment, and talk about some of the times in our history when we have discussed this so that we see that not only is it something that we value, which we already do, but it is something that would be possible if we would put the time and energy into making it happen.
I'm sure that you have heard any time you talk about it, also in addition to perhaps having people who are supportive, you heard the same kind of objections. Certainly, any time we talk about raising the minimum wage, even a small increase, people will argue that the economy can't support it, that it particularly falls hard on employers who have smaller numbers of employees, and that one of the things that would be likely to happen if you forced employers to pay their workers more is that they would end up laying people off. So we would actually have an increase in unemployment. Here we're talking about not just a small increase in the minimum, but we're talking about a very dramatic increase in the minimum, a doubling of the minimum. And I'm sure that people would even more strenuously make that argument that says, number one, we can't afford it. And number two, if you force us to do this, what's going to happen is that people are actually, we're going to actually have a loss of jobs. More people are going to be unemployed than are today.
Right. And I think that is something that has to be discussed and has to be discussed realistically. You know, the minimum wage has been raised 18 times on the national level, and every single time, David, as you point out, every single time there's a discussion about raising it, there is the criticism that raising it is going to destroy jobs and it is going to wreck the economy and that people are going to be laid off en masse and that all kinds of businesses are going to go out of business. And that the effect of that, of people who have studied that, say that in fact does not happen. You're right that what I'm talking about is a much more significant raise than has been talked about in the past. And so the transition time will have to maybe be more measured, and the effects and trying to cushion some of the effects on businesses will have to be even more a part of what's happened. But the last time, every time almost, that we raise the minimum wage, we provide incentives and tax breaks to employers to be able to assist them in the transition to that. The question is, you know, do we value it? And then if we value it, what is the cost that we're willing to pay, and how do we pay it? We have things that happen every day in Congress and in our legislatures where we're making decisions that change the economy, that change the rules of the economy. I'm sure most of your listeners are like me, either are buying their own home or would like and hope to buy their own home. That is a $100 billion a year program that is a part of the economic system that we have created because we think it's important that people ought to be able to own their own home. And so we have mortgage deductions and special tax breaks and incentives in that to get people into that. That helps not only you and me and other people who are trying to buy their own homes, but it helps the construction industry that builds homes, helps the real estate industry in selling homes, helps the bank industries that mortgage these things. And yet there's a big price on that, but it is something that we value, so we're willing to do it because we think it is a social good. And what I'm saying in this book and what others are saying around the country is that making sure that people have the right to a job at a living wage is just as important as making sure that people have a right to have an opportunity to buy a home. And so not that it's simple or it's easy or you just snap your fingers and it happens, but that if it is important to the community and it's important for the health of the community, that there are ways that we can do it, and there's ways that we can spread the cost around.
We have a caller and would welcome others. If you have questions, comments for our guests, all you need to do is call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us, if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, use the toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Chicago to start with on our line 4. Hello.
Hello, good morning. Yeah. I find this very interesting because I have noticed, or have you noticed, that some politicians, I'm not going to mention parties because I don't want to necessarily get into that, but some politicians who complain about people on welfare are the same ones who will oppose the minimum wage being raised every time.
That's right.
And they don't realize that if you really want to get people off of welfare, you need to raise the minimum wage, and that'll go a long way toward getting them off. But for whatever reason, a lot of these people who are on the conservative side, I have to say, will complain and will go before crowds to talk about how the welfare problem is really bad, but yet they'll oppose a minimum wage raise.
Well, we have some sort of conflicts that are part of our political system, and that is that, you know, for welfare reform, for example, we have done a very good job with this welfare reform of getting people off of welfare. The welfare rolls have been cut more than in half by the mothers and kids who were on welfare. Most of those people who've left welfare are working at some sort of minimum wage or within a couple of bucks of minimum wage jobs. So we value work, and we have done a good job, I'd say, like with the sticks, you know, carrot and stick. We're doing a good job with the stick of getting people to work, but we need to also do some jobs with the carrots.
I agree. What would you say if they raised the minimum wage to $10, but they said if you hire an employee, we'll give you a $2,000 tax break or something like that?
Right. There, I suggest in the book that, these are not suggestions that I created. These are there's dozens of these things out there. There are all kinds of ways to give tax incentives, credits, subsidies, and the like to private business to be able to do this, because private business is the number one source of work for all of us, and that has to be supported. We have to make that part of it. I also suggest that if private business doesn't do it, then there's a role for the public economy to be able to absorb folks if the private businesses won't do it or can't do it. But I think there are plenty of ways to be able to reward people for creating and maintaining good jobs, if we think that is important. Our economic policy here lately has been a different style, that we have said that the best thing to do is to give more tax breaks and more money to the higher income people, and that by doing that, it's the hope that they will spend more money and more jobs.
And it'll sort of trickle down.
Yeah, you know, I'm not saying those people are insincere. They may actually believe that that's the way to do it. It doesn't appear that that's the way to do it.
You know what? In the 19th century, a lot of people made, and all these industrialists made money, but I didn't see any of them trickling it down.
Well, I would agree with you. The history shows that it does take the government to have leadership in terms of trying to make sure that the community good is protected, that it's not just people on their own, although you can't discount the importance of private charity and private generosity, but in a society as complex as ours, it does take a role for the government. Government is not a bad word. To many people, it is. Any time you talk about government getting involved in providing jobs or government ordering folks to pay more money, that some people just think that is wrong under all circumstances.
Well, you know, they had people that didn't support President Roosevelt even when he came into office and wanted to do the things that he did. Even though I think if he hadn't come in, we'd have had a very different lifestyle today. I think it would have been a revolution or something, and we'd all be living differently today.
Well, I think the point about what happened during the New Deal, and that is a very instructive one that not everybody remembers. And every city and town in our country has bridges and buildings and roads and that were built under the Public Works Administration,
or
where
the TVA, the Tennessee Valley.
Yeah, where people, the government, because there weren't enough jobs, the government hired people and had them do the jobs that needed to be done and paid them, because people did not want unemployment. They didn't want soup lines and bread lines and that. They wanted a job. They wanted the chance to work themselves out of poverty. And in my experience, there are tens of millions of people in this country who want the same thing right now.
But I agree. And if we don't support the minimum wage, we'll probably end up supporting a lot of these people in our prisons.
Well, that is, the, you know, and I think David was sort of leading us to that, in that there is a cost to raising the minimum wage, you know, to doubling. There is a cost, but there is a substantial cost for maintaining the system that we have right now. We have 2 million people in prison. We have a deteriorating educational system. We are paying for food stamps, for Medicaid, for subsidized housing, for subsidized transportation, for a lot of things that people would much rather pay for on their own. They'd much rather have the money and make those choices on their own. And the government, that's for the employed. For the unemployed, Congress estimates that we're paying $80 billion a year for every 1% of unemployment.
Wow.
So we're at $500 billion a year is the cost for the unemployment that we're absorbing right now. So we are paying a big price for it right now. It's not quite as visible a price as it might be if it was a line item in the budget, but we are paying a cost, and that's just the financial cost. The social cost, most people have had experience or somebody in their family has been unemployed for a while, and they know that you know, it hurts people's self-respect, it hurts the family dynamics, oftentimes leads to a family breakup, and also know that the impact of people that have to work full-time, single parents, the impact on kids, two parents working where they're not making ends meet, is very, very difficult. And for some people, it makes the character tremendous, and it gives them great stories to be able to tell their children and grandchildren. But for a lot of people, it is just real, very, very difficult. And I think they are the ones that most of us would believe deserve some community support. And so that's what, hopefully, that's what this is talking about.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Thank you for the call. Let's go to the next person in line, and that would be a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if your book also addresses the other side of the poverty equation, not just focusing on income, but also on spending side, and specifically I'm referring to there are a lot of businesses that are designed to prey on vulnerable, debt-stressed individuals that strip wealth from low and moderate income families, such as payday loan stores, rapid refund operations, and I was just wondering if you also addressed that.
No, I didn't in the book, but I mean you're absolutely right. There are people who actually do make money off of the current situation. I mean, there's plenty of people in the stock market and on the top who are very happy with the way things are going. But there are also plenty of people, as you point out, that take advantage of the desperation of folks. And that is another book that I would love to read or write myself. I think you're absolutely right about that, but the book doesn't address that.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
you give me the occasion to say that a friend of my son's just put up a website that tells a little bit about the book and lets people read the first chapter for free if they would like, which is www.endingpoverty.com. And that has some links to some other organizations, some national organizations who are working on living wage and the like.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're talking about is a very there is an entire industry out there that, as you say, preys on the folks who are so desperately trying to make ends meet and are not able to do it.
Mm-hmm. I've been a legal services attorney for 19 years, and I feel that attention to those issues has been pretty neglected. There's one really good book on the subject that kind of predates some of the most recent examples of that, but that would be Michael Hudson's book, Merchants of Misery, How Corporate America Profits from Poverty.
Well, I'm going to look at that. That sounds good. I was a legal services lawyer for 5 years, so I'm happy to talk with a fellow legal services lawyer. One of the people that really do work with low-income folks and see what they're up against on a day-to-day basis. So thanks for calling.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here, maybe more than a little bit past the midpoint. I do want to introduce again our guest for anyone who's tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. William Quigley is professor of law at Loyola University in New Orleans. He has been an active public interest lawyer for over 20 years. He's litigated many cases with the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. He also served as general counsel for the ACLU of Louisiana for 15 years. And he makes the argument for the concept of the living wage in a book that he's written. It's titled Ending Poverty as We Know It, Guaranteeing a Right to a Job at a Living Wage. It's published in paperback by the Temple University Press. And in fact, he argues that there ought to be a constitutional amendment to guarantee a job at a living wage to all American workers. So if you're interested in reading about that, you can head out to the bookstore and look for the book. Or, as he suggests, look at this website, www.endingpoverty.com. You can find out more about the book. We have other callers. And next in line is a caller in Aurora on line number 3. Hello.
I recall when much money was given to General Motors. I forget the man that was working there then to save General Motors and the jobs that it would supply. Why aren't we doing like this recent business with Levi? They have lost 800 workers a couple of weeks ago because they no longer can make the product cheaper than it being shipped in. Why aren't those things done? Why don't we save what we have in this country, the jobs we have in this country?
Well, I think that's a very good point, and that's part of what I think this sort of change of orientation would be if we would do a constitutional amendment that says that jobs are very, very important, that any time that we would assist an industry, I think what you were talking about actually was Chrysler, and Lee Iacocca on the bailout.
Yeah, that's who it was.
But we also, after September 11th, had the same thing of the big bailout of the airline industries who turned around and laid off tens of thousands of workers. So part of, you know, assisting businesses is great, but assisting businesses who turn around and don't take care of their workers is counterproductive. We do not need businesses that are not good, solid community employers, and unless that's part of what they are doing, then we shouldn't be in the business of working on that. So all of our assistance to business and industry should be, as one of the priorities, is do you create jobs? Will you maintain jobs? There are dynamics that go on in the world economy and always have and always will where there are going to be changes in what we think are the changes, and what the changes we see happening right now in 10 or 20 years are going to be other kinds of changes. But at each change time, there is always an opportunity for other opportunities to come in and create new things. And we should be in the business of making sure that people protect those jobs that we do have, if we can. And if we can't, then we shouldn't be assisting people who are laying folks off. That's just flat part of it. We don't need those types of businesses.
Well, do you know why Levi went out of business?
I do
out
not.
Of the United States?
I do not, ma'am.
Well, must be they couldn't keep up with the competition that was coming in.
That may well be, but the issue is what has the United States government and state and local government provided to Levi's and to other companies who are doing that? Have we conditioned our assistance to them on the fact that they will, in fact, keep jobs here? Because, I mean, if they're not going to keep jobs here, then why do we need to help them? That's the question that I would ask, and that's the question I think needs to be a part of every decision about assisting businesses. Businesses are in the Illinois legislature and the Louisiana legislature and the state and the U.S. Congress every day trying to get laws passed to help them. And I say, you know, more power to them. That's democracy. Let them do that. But make a part of all of those things protecting the workers, because if a business makes a profit but it harms workers or lays people off, then it's not really contributing to the health of the community if jobs are what we really need.
Well, I have a young man that hasn't worked in a year, and he's doing painting for me. So take care. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, you know, the caller does raise in my mind the issue of globalization of the economy.
Absolutely.
And that some people also will say another one of the problems we might face if indeed we did what you advocate and we effectively increase the minimum wage from $5 to $10 is that that is going to put even greater pressure on employers, and they'll be looking at this wage difference between what they have to pay their American workers and what they could pay a worker in another country. And some people, I think, might say that until there is a global living wage, if we have a living wage, all that's going to do is accelerate the job loss from this country, and more jobs will move overseas where employers can get away with paying their employees a whole lot less.
Well, you're 100% right that that is what people are going to say. In fact, they have been saying it for some time, even in terms of the minimum wage, that we shouldn't have a minimum wage because that puts us at a disadvantage in terms of the rest of the world. You know, when people are being paid 30 cents an hour in some place, how can we compete at $5 an hour? But I think, you know, there is an economic part to that argument, and there's also a community part and a community justice part that argue. We could give everybody in this country a job if we paid them, you know, 30 cents an hour. But is that what we want? And do we want to wait until, you know, other countries pay $6 an hour before we try to take care of the people in this country? I don't think so. I mean, I think most people are not willing to do that. And I also think that most people are rightfully not convinced that the main reason that we don't have living wages is because the rest of the workers in the world are making lots and lots of money. Over the last 20 to 30 years, there has been a tremendous accumulation of wealth in this country, but it has not been evenly distributed. And so the only way that trying to assist workers is going to happen is if there is more even distribution of the profits that we have. And we are a very rich country, there's no doubt about that. But have the riches of the country been equally, or not even equally, evenly or fairly distributed, or have people been working and going backwards or standing still while the rest of the country is going forward? And I think most people would say that yes, there are people that are being treated unfairly, but they will say there isn't anything we can do about it. The issue of globalization is important because most of these low-wage jobs that we're talking about, most of the 30 million low-wage jobs are not jobs that are going to go overseas. I mean, we can't go overseas to check out at the drugstore. We can't go overseas to bring our kids to daycare. We can't go overseas for nursing home operators. We can't go overseas for restaurants and hotels and stuff that we have in this country. So an awful lot of those jobs are not going anywhere. They're going to be here no matter what. And it's a question of whether we want to commit to trying to be fair to pay people who work very hard and to try to readjust some of the way the money is being distributed. And the point I wanted to make that was implied in one of your other questions was, if we raise the minimum wage, and this comes up each time, if we raise the minimum wage a dollar or two even, won't that just mean that, you know, the price of a hamburger or the price of things at the drugstore, that is all going to go up a dollar or two, and low-wage workers are going to immediately lose any advantage that they would have gotten because of a raise? And I would say a couple things to that. One is, I don't know any of us who don't make low wages who would ever say, I don't want you to pay me more because, you know, it'll just be lost, you know, through being absorbed in the entire community. We all want to be paid more. We all think that we can do something with the money that we get. And the second part of that is, you know, poor people are not different than any of the rest of us in that. But the second part of that is that if you raise the minimum wage by a dollar or two, or more, then certainly the price of a hamburger would go up and the price of French fries would go up, but they wouldn't go up a dollar or two because the labor part of the job is a small percentage of the overall cost. So the price of a hamburger would go up, and we wouldn't expect the business owner of the hamburger place to just absorb all that increased wages. They would pass it on. But hamburgers are not eaten just by low-income people. They're eaten by middle-class people and upper-class people as well. So that price of that hamburger and the price of that wage increase would be distributed among the entire community. And that goes back to this point about a more fair distribution of the benefits that this country has managed to accumulate.
We have only about 7 minutes left. I have several callers. We'll
okay,
try to
sorry.
Get in a couple more. We appreciate the thoroughness and thoughtfulness of your answers. I'm not suggesting that you should. It was wrong not to give 30-second answers. Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi, Professor Quigley. Evaluating our present economy, one of the main problems of business is low margins, low per unit profits. So the only way businesses can increase profits is to cut costs. They need to cut costs, but increasing minimum wages seriously raises costs. And also, as David just mentioned, right now we're in a job-losing economic recovery where businesses are transferring their operations overseas because overseas labor costs are so much lower. Now, you talk about community justice in raising minimum wage, but that doesn't increase it doesn't increase wages. The jobs are lost. The businesses, the whole business, goes overseas. And entry-level jobs, the minimum wage jobs, are simply eliminated. The price of hamburgers doesn't go up because we're in a price squeeze now. We're in a period of low margins. Somebody learns to make hamburgers faster. You raise the wages enough, and guess what? They'll learn to make hamburgers without those workers.
Well, Professor Quigley, what do you think?
Well, I think that's where the other part of the constitutional amendment comes in, which is that people would have the right to a job. And the right to a job, one of the things that we're talking about in terms of the job-losing economy is that our state and local governments are being stripped of jobs, but they are being stripped of jobs that are not going overseas. They're just not being addressed. Our educational institutions, our healthcare institutions, the community services that governments have been able to provide in the past, every one of the 50 state governments right now is looking at cutbacks because of the transfer of income, the transfer of assets that's happening on the national level where decisions have been made that we're not putting things into public job creation, public support for programs, public service, public education and the like, but instead we are doing it in tax cuts. And what I would suggest, we can't do that. We can't just reduce the responsibility of people to pay for community services and expect increased community services. So part of the reason that we're losing jobs in the national economy is because our public sector is being starved out. And that's why it would take a significant change in what we're doing in order to be able to address it.
We're coming to a point where we have a couple minutes, and just one last question I'd like to raise, and I hope the callers will forgive me, is the difficulty of passing a constitutional amendment. It's amending the Constitution's hard, and the people who created the Constitution made it that way on purpose. They didn't want it to be easy. It's difficult, and then this particular issue is politically extremely difficult, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would perhaps be in harmony with your argument and say that would be a wonderful thing, but that the possibility of amending the Constitution to include this is next to impossible, and so we might as well just not even be talking about it.
Right. I think if you're talking about today, that is exactly correct. It is very difficult to amend the Constitution, and that's a good thing, because when we make a constitutional amendment, that is something that we're going to live with for a good long time. But looking back at our history, when people started discussing abolishing slavery, people say we can't do that. Economically, morally, structurally, it would be a disaster. We can't do it. Politically, it would never work. When we talked about letting women have the right to vote, they were saying it can't happen, it shouldn't happen, and that has never happened in the past. When we talk about creating programs like Social Security or getting rid of child labor or creating the minimum wage to begin with, at the beginning of those conversations, it was always, well, that might be a nice idea, but it's impossible. And the hope is that this book will help crystallize and help share some of the arguments that are going on out there right now and provide some of the initial steps to discuss it. If people do not like it, then it will never pass and we'll be safe from it. But if it is something that does resonate and people say, well, I would like to look further into that, then advances that seem impossible become possible once people start studying them and saying that this is worth the price that we need to pay.
There are a number of communities across the country that have passed living wage ordinances that, at the very least, what they do is they cover people who do business with local government. So if you have a business and you contract with the city or the county, then you have to pay a living wage. And I guess the living wage that's required here, you know, it covers anywhere between, well, I think about $6 to, I think, $12 is the top. Do you think that those campaigns have been successful? And some people, I suppose, would say, well, that's the way to get the foot in the door is by doing it like that.
Yes, there are 75 governments across the country that have done some form of living wage, with another couple hundred that are discussing it. And those are what I think are the real seeds of hope that are out there, because those are community organizations, church organizations, labor unions, other groups that are saying, look, we have to create opportunities for people to be able to earn enough to be able to live. And there are ways that we can do it. And so, but in each one of those communities, people at the beginning were told that it is impossible. And it is those campaigns and the people who have worked so hard in those campaigns that I think really provides the seeds of hope that there may come a time when those campaigns around the country are able to link up to do something on a national basis as well. They are helping to create laboratories where we can see how these things work, what doesn't work, and make decisions whether these things are good for our communities or not.
There we must leave it. If people are interested in reading more on the subject, you can look for the book that we've been talking about, Ending Poverty as We Know It, by our guest William Quigley. He's professor of law at Loyola University in New Orleans, and the book is published by the Temple University Press. And Professor Quigley, thank you very much.
Thank you.